This is an ASF Audits podcast.
Welcome to the SMSF Experts podcast, where we break down complex SMSF issues for professionals into simple terms. I'm your host, Shelley Banton, Head of Technical at ASF Audits, and in this episode, we're providing an SMSF community service by looking at how the SMSF administration software is going to handle underpaid pensions from the 2025 financial year on. Because, as we know, the rules have changed, but unfortunately, the software hasn't been able to. So how are you going to process that underpaid pension through the software without making it more complex than necessary? Well, I can tell you it already is complex, but to help us step through it all calmly and logically, I'm joined by Sean Johnson, SMSF Specialist at Heffron. Sean has over 13 years of industry experience, and like me, he's passionate about simplifying the complexities of superannuation into easy-to-understand formats. So we're going to step through very quickly what underpaying a pension means, what the consequences are, and most importantly, then take a deep dive into how to fix it from a software perspective. Let's get into it. Welcome to the SMSF Expert, Sean, and thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks, Shelley. Thanks for having me. I'm quite excited to get through this one, although the tears have flown in the background trying to get to where we are now.
It comes with a little bit of trepidation. I'm hearing you. Well, Sean, the first thing I actually want to talk to you about is your love of baking. Because yes. I know that you've used the analogy of baking a chocolate cake before to address superannuation inequality. So where did that all start and what's your favourite thing to bake?
It's funny that I use that analogy, Shelley, because what I like to make is cheesecakes. And one of the primary reasons I like making cheesecakes is because I actually don't have to turn the oven on. I can get by doing a lot of them without having to bake them. But I just quite like cheesecake. I like cake in general. Who doesn't?
Yep.
And so that's where it all started. And in that particular case, I think it was a relatively apt analogy for basically trying to change something after you've already built the system, which kind of doesn't work. And kind of leans into what we're talking about today, because we have a system in place that has fundamentally changed. And so there's some great parallels there between the two.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I'll be looking forward to sharing what you've brought into to the studio with us after the pod. So thanks for that in advance. Let's get started, though. What exactly changed with the ATO's June 2024 update to TR 2013/5? And why does it matter for pension underpayments now?
Yeah, sure. So I probably should lay some groundwork here, just for those listeners who might be, I suppose, a little bit unsure of where we start with some of this stuff. What we have in the superannuation system are pensions, and we colloquially call them pensions. And they're an interaction of effectively three sets of law. So they're an interaction of the tax law, so the Tax Act and the tax regs, the CIS law and CIS regs, and then you've got the common contract law element of this is a contract between the trustees and the members to pay a pension, to pay a series of income streams to a person. And those laws, for the most part, have come about independently of each other, but in certain places refer to each other or rely on the concepts of one another. And sometimes that means they don't play particularly well together. And I think once that groundwork has been laid and we understand what pensions are in terms of the interactions of three separate bits of law, we probably should talk about what used to happen in the olden days or pre the update. So if we go back to before the update in June, we effectively had a system where if a pension had failed for any reason, and failure can happen for a number of reasons, but the most common one is that people don't take the minimum pension payments they need to take. So pensions have a minimum pension requirement, and if you don't meet that minimum pension requirement, the pension fails. There are other ways pensions can fail, but that's the most common one. It's the one that most practitioners would be familiar with. So in the old system, if a pension had failed, you lost all of your exempt current pension income. Now, exempt current pension income is effectively the portion of the super fund's income that doesn't pay tax because the capital that has generated that income is supporting that pension. So we lose that in respect of that particular pension that has failed, for the year in which that pension had failed. So if we were talking about a pension that had failed in the 2024 financial year, so it hadn't taken its minimum pensions in the 2024 financial year, you wouldn't get exempt income on that pension for the 2024 FY. Now, the crucial difference is what happens when it restarts or what happens in the next financial year. Under the old system, we basically said, if you have that pension in place, it stays in place. And as long as you start to take your minimum pension payments again and you meet that minimum threshold in the next financial year, that pension is deemed to have been restarted. And so you get your exempt current pension income back. And that pension effectively is brand new. Now, all of that was failure for tax purposes. So there was other sort of consequences in there, which we'll talk about some of those a bit later in terms of the new processing. But effectively, that pension could restart again simply because you'd taken the minimum pension payments again in the next year. What the changes to TR 2013-5 have said is that once that pension fails once for CIS purposes, it can never again be a complying pension for CIS purposes in the future, and thus it can't ever be a complying pension again for tax purposes either. And you will basically lose your exempt income on that pension and a few of the other benefits, again, haven't talked about them yet, up until the point that you stop that pension voluntarily and then restart it, assuming you want to restart it, but most people will. And so what you've got now is a system where if we'd failed a pension in 2025 under the old rules, we'd lose that ECPI for 2025, we'd start taking our minimum payments in 2026, and we'd move forward. Now, we fail for 2025, we lose our ECPI for 2025, we also lose ECPI for a period of 2026, up until the member makes a decision to stop their pension. And let's say, for example, they did that today, you would lose that ECPI up until today. And so it now spills over into two financial years and potentially more. And that's problematic because a lot of the time we don't find minimum pension failures too later in the year when we're picking up the fund, when we're trying to reconcile through transactions, when the shoebox comes in effectively.
So previously, before these rule change, we just had an impact from the tax side of things with the ECPI. Now we've got an impact from the tax and the superannuation point of view because you then have to, once you've failed that meeting that minimum, you have to then commute it at a point that you find out about it, which we've got a whole lot of then timing issues as well. Now, we do just want to make a note here that if you fail the pension by less than 1/12, you can still self-assess. So that option is still available to you. It doesn't creep into this new set of rules, but obviously that 1/12 assessment applies to per fund. It doesn't apply to per member and it doesn't apply to per member interest. And we need to be aware of that. Now, if you need more information on that, go and listen to the podcast we did previously with Peter Crump on all about underpaying pensions as well. But moving on, Sean, let's discuss what's going to happen, I guess, from a software perspective, because we've got a lot of moving parts here. You've got a way in which you have to account for it from a taxation point of view, but you also have to account for it from a superannuation point of view at the moment that you find out about it, which is not necessarily the same point that you have to commute it back to for the taxation.
Yeah, correct. And I think this is not a case of us going out there and bashing the software companies. This is something that is effectively a fundamental change to the way that we have to think about pensions if they fail. And it would take basically all of the software companies rebuilding their systems from the ground up. And I think probably the easiest way to get through why that's the case is to talk about the various reporting things and the numbers that we need around them. That will sort of illustrate the point that quite often we're looking at something here that looks like two or three separate pensions, but we're all running the same pension. We just need different values that are sometimes contradictory at different points in time. So If you'll indulge me a little bit, Shelley, I have some notes in front of me because this does get complex.
It does. Can I just interrupt here for a second, though? And can I just mention, too, that the entire reason we're doing this podcast, as I mentioned during my intro, is to provide a solution for the SMSF industry. Now, there's probably going to be several solutions out there, and we're very appreciative to have you here with us today, Sean, to share the way in which Heffron is going to be moving forward with this. But the fact is that none of the software companies have been able to update their software to comply with the new rules. And I'm sure you're going to be going through those reasons why, because the first thing is that we're not here to criticize any of the software companies because they provide a fabulous service to our industry. I just wanted to put that in perspective because I think it's a really important point to note. We're here to provide a service and hopefully help out the industry. We're not here to criticize those companies who have made a commercial decision, and quite rightly so, in terms of not being able to update the software for various reasons. So I'll leave that back to you.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. This is genuinely, I was sitting here working through this process thinking, I don't think you could do this in Excel. If you were keeping your accounts in Excel, you would still have to run things simultaneously. So asking any of the software companies to do this would be a complete restructure of all of their software. It would be a fundamental rebuild from the ground up, and that's not a viable solution.
You can't. You've got timing issues. They've got competing priorities. They've got change fatigue because we've seen a lot happen within the industry over the last 3 to 5 years. You've got to be realistic as well. So
yeah, and to a certain extent, this was changed on the whim of the ATO. There's nothing, whilst it's unlikely, there's nothing to say that at some point in the future, a different interpretation might not come out, and it could completely have force a rewrite again from there.
Yeah, I think APRA got the results that they wanted to, so I don't think that's going to really go back. No. But anyway, we're not going there, girlfriend.
But yes, to work through, so I think I'll start with a timeline of what we need to report and when.
Wonderful.
And we'll talk a little bit after that how that complicates things within the software, because just getting the baseline of what we need to do first really starts to highlight some of the problems that we're going to have going forward. So I'm going to talk about this pension failure as if it's failed in the 2025 financial year, just to make that simple for everybody. So this is a pension that existed at 1 July 2024. Somewhere in the 2025 financial year, it has not managed to take its minimum pensions. And I'm not going to put numbers around it at this point, just because that makes it complex for everybody listening at home, because they can't see numbers.
And it's also important to note that the ATO isn't applying compliance resources to any underpaid pensions before the 2025 financial year as well. Yeah.
And I will talk about that later too, because I absolutely hate that phrase.
Yeah.
But we'll come back to that, I think. So if we start to look at what happens with this pension when it fails. So from 1 July in the year of failure, so 1 July 2024 in this case, the pension fails to be a pension that complies with the SIS regs. It fails for tax purposes. So at this point, you lose your exempt income. So from 1 July forward, you get no exempt income on that pension. That pension will also merge its tax components with any balances that you have in accumulation. So if you have $1 million, that's all taxable component in your accumulation balance. Any pension that fails will merge with that pension for component purposes, with that accumulation balance for component purposes from 1 July.
Which is a ripper for estate planning, isn't it, Sean?
It can be.
I was being a bit facetious there, but anyway.
Now, through the year, you might still have pension payments that are to be allocated to that pension. So if you think about potentially a fund that might have some instructions on how they're to process payments or lump sums, those still get allocated like they would have been had that pension not failed, because contractually you still have a pension in place. But those pension payments are pension payments for contractual and accounting purposes. For SIS and tax purposes, they are lump sums. Now, because that pension has failed, every single one of those inverted commas, lump sums that comes out through the year will have slightly different tax components attached to it. And if you're taking payments from it, you will need to adjust the tax components of those payments the same as you would if you had an accumulation balance and somebody was taking regular lump sums out of the accumulation balance. So for those of us processing it in the software, that would mean period closes every time somebody takes a payment. At 30 June in the year of failure, you have a transfer balance cap entry for that failed pension, because when we fail a pension, particularly for minimum pension failures, we don't know that we've failed that pension until that nanosecond before 30 June ticks over. And so we have a failure T-bar, and it's not a commutation. It's a pension stops being in accumulation phase T-bar. But there's a little quirk to this. The value of that T-bar entry is based on that pension getting exempt income for the whole financial year, because there's a little rider in the section of the Tax Act that talks about how we work out what our debits and credits are. And it says for failed pensions, or the context is for failed pensions, assume that you get ECPI right up and to the point just before that pension fails. And so we have to calculate that balance with ECPI. But remember, that pension doesn't get ECPI. So the actual balance of that pension is probably going to be significantly less. And then that's the value you use for accounting and tax purposes, the value without exempt income attached to that pension. So again, there's one of those contradictory parts. So we finalise our fund for the 30 June 2025 year end. Now, let's assume that we've only found that minimum pension failure when we're doing the accounts today. So we get all the way through till now, when we're recording this, and that pension is still failed. It still exists. It's still a pension for accounting and contractual law purposes, but for tax and CIS law purposes, it's not a pension. But it still sits there in our accounts, or at least notionally should still sit there till our accounts. As I said before, we have to voluntarily commute that pension and then restart it. But we all know that if you're commuting a pension, you have to take a minimum pension payment before you commute it. Now, that's probably a little bit contentious, because this pension notionally doesn't comply with CIS regs, but we're not necessarily sure that you still don't have to take that commutation. But your prorated minimum, if you are going to take it, which we generally suggest you do just so you don't inadvertently fall foul of the commutation rules, is going to be based on the value of that pension without ECPI at 30 June. So then we calculate our prorated minimum pension. Now we come all the way to today's date and we choose to voluntarily commute that pension. Now we have a commutation that is effective for CIS law purposes because we've made it effective for CIS law purposes. We have a commutation that is valid for accounting and contractual law purposes, but we don't have a commutation for tax law purposes because that pension stopped being a pension, or stopped being a retirement phase pension, way back at 30 June. And then let's assume we're starting another pension. We then start another pension like normal from today's date.
You still have to lodge the T-bar, don't you?
For the commutation that you do now? No, because that pension has stopped. It's no longer a retirement phase pension because we stopped being in retirement phase at 30 June. And so it's effectively done as far as T-bars are concerned. You do have to lodge one when you restart the pension, though.
Yep. And so that's where the timing comes mm-hmm. in terms of this being really important and making sure that you're doing it correctly.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think when I start to explain that and I sit there and walk through it, I can see Shelley's eyes rolling a little bit. And
no, that's what No.
I can feel that. So we sat down and done a lot of work on this, and I felt that the whole way through it. I was sitting there just head in my hands going, oh, this is genuinely a nightmare because there's quite a lot of places here that I need two separate values for the pension at the same time to do two completely separate things and they don't talk to each other.
That's right. Yeah.
And I suppose coming back to Shelley's point, that's one of the reasons that this is going to be very difficult for the software providers to actually build around this. Because it implies that we almost have two pensions in place, potentially three, and we're picking and choosing the bits we need and how then you dove them back together for the various bits to get the right amount in your financials and those sorts of things.
And that's the point, isn't it? You can't expect to have parallel rails of superannuation interests with what's happening with all of this underpaid pension work within the software and then somehow merge together at the end of the day. It's just, it is just a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, and you're also talking about probably a very small percentage of funds that have failed pensions. Overwhelming majority, I'd say it'd be 99.9% of pensions that we deal with have no problems. And whilst they're painful when they come up, it's probably impractical to build around that.
Yeah, that's it. And this is, I guess, too, where your data feeds come into play a little bit more because they become a very important piece in any fund that is paying a pension.
100%. Data feeds do a lot of the heavy lifting at the front end. So this is one of those cases where prevention is obviously better than a cure. So I can sit here and talk about how we fix this, what we can do in our softwares, those sorts of things, till the cows come home. Ultimately, really, though, what we want is to just not have failed pensions in the first place. It is significantly easier to get ahead of that, to review your pensions, to go out to clients and advisors and contact them and say, hey, you need to take a little bit more pension payment if you've got live real-time data. If you're relying on the old shoebox accounts or you've got things that maybe not quite as bad as a shoebox but quite periodic, it gets really hard to get ahead of that. It gets really hard to work around things that don't data feed, that will never data feed. So, you know, things like property, for example. Any visibility is better than none. So if I can have all of your assets data feeding except the things that will never feed, that gives me a significantly better jumping off point and lets me work around all of the other intricacies of those things that don't feed with so much more confidence than just what happens if we've got no visibility of everything at all.
So really two points to note there. Firstly is that if you've got clients who are in pension phase, it's almost best practice to consider having a data feed for them. And you'd really have to ask yourself, why don't I have a data feed for those particular clients? And secondly, I can tell you from an audit perspective that if you've got a data feed in place, you will tend to have less queries, which means that your audits will go through a lot more smoothly than if you don't have data feeds. And we've got evidence to 100% back that up. But anyway, we're not talking about client success at the moment. What's next in the step in the process, Sean? Where do we go from here?
It depends on what part of the process we want to look at. Without getting too far into the mechanics at this stage, and we'll probably touch a bit more on the mechanics a little bit later, I think your first step after you get through all of the work we talked about in terms of making sure that the prevention is better than the cure, making sure that people take their minimums, is jumping in very quickly after the end of the financial year. And again, this speaks to your point before about data feeds.
And best practice.
Jumping in that first couple of weeks of July and re-reviewing all of your minimum pensions. Because the faster you can pick up that somebody has failed to meet their minimum pensions, the faster we can get round to doing all that stuff that we need to do, commuting and restarting the pension, the less damage there's going to be at an ECPI front, particularly, and hope this isn't the case for anyone, but particularly if you're the practitioner that's on the hook for that. Because if it's sitting in your wheelhouse to compensate a client for that, or it's something that's going to go on your PI, I reckon I'd want to minimise that damage as quickly as possible. So I think that turning around in July and re-reviewing all your pensions, if you can, is the absolute most crucial step after taking all of those preventative actions.
And that's the value add there, because even if you're reviewing your pensions before 30th of June, say 1st of June, so that you're letting your clients know that there's still X dollars that they have to pay out to meet the minimum, it's still up to the trustees to make sure that's paid, and you actually can't do anything about it. So if you're then being proactive and you're getting into step as soon as you can after the 30th of June, that's going to be that value add that you can give to your clients.
Oh, 100%. And that is one of the things that's really appreciated, I think, by clients, is particularly where there's circumstances, I suppose, that wouldn't be mitigating, but they would be things that potentially outside of their control or things they didn't factor in. So not so much an issue this last year, but if we go back to 2024, 30 June fell on a Sunday from memory. And there were a lot of people that put, say, their bank transfers through on the Sunday afternoon and they didn't go through.
Yeah.
And so picking up things like that for your clients where it's just something that's out of their control, largely. There's a little bit of control there, but largely out of their control. That's where they really appreciate the service that you give.
They will, and so will your PI insurer.
Very much so.
Yeah, very muchly. All right then. So once we've got those mechanics under our belt, is our next step looking at bringing them back? We've already touched on calculating those tax components in accumulation. So then you're looking at getting to where you're actually going to commute that pension. Is that where we're at?
Yeah. So there's probably some interesting steps in the middle that we somewhat have a bit more flexibility about as SMSF practitioners. And that's notionally where the payments, if any, that have been taken during the year are allocated to, and whether they are pension payments from that failed pension or whether they're pension payments that belong to, say, another pension, lump sums from accumulation. Now, none of that can be decided after the fact. We can, as practitioners, find out about it after the fact. So trustees quite often make decisions and don't tell us about it. But we shouldn't be, as practitioners, sitting here assuming the trustee's intentions if we don't know them. So we probably should, in the middle there, be going back out to them and clarifying, hey, you are short on your pensions. Were all of these just from this one pension? Or were they from multiple pensions spread across them with some failures? Were they lump sums from accumulation? And again, can't do anything retrospectively there. So they have to have made those decisions beforehand, but they don't have to have necessarily told you about the decision to do that before they did it. You're the middleman in this situation. You're just the one doing the accounting. It's nice if they do keep you in the loop, but certainly not a requirement that they do.
So what you're saying is that we're going to be seeing the reemergence of member accounts that have 10 to 20 pension accounts. So if you're underpaying them, they're going to not be a massive impost on the fund's lack of being able to claim ECPI. It's only going to affect a smaller range of smaller pensions, hopefully.
Smaller capital balance. Look, it's one of those things that I always advocate to clients if they say to me, why would I start a second pension with these new contributions I've put in rather than, say, commuting my existing pension and recombining them? Aside from the benefits of isolating tax components and those sorts of things that flow on from multiple pensions, that is one of the absolute big benefits that I always espouse to clients is, hey, if you have multiple pensions and you just so happen to fail, potentially we only have to fail one pension rather than failing a pension that takes up your whole balance.
Yeah, and we used to traditionally, we still see multiple pensions, but we used to see 12 and 15 pensions in a super fund as opposed to maybe the single digit number of pension accounts we see now. So that is going to be something that auditors will be looking forward to, no doubt.
Absolutely. And to speak to that a little bit, I had one of the younger people in the office, and that sounds horrible for me to say, but one of the younger people in the office come up to me and say, hey, Sean, have you ever seen 10 pensions in a super fund before? I was like, oh, you sweet summer child.
Okay, that sounds a bit creepy. We might move on from that one. So where are we up to? It's so easy to just lose your place. You have to go through this methodologically because otherwise you're going to lose the plot and you're going to miss something as well.
Yeah, so that's probably my goal for the next month or so is to actually get, so we've developed a framework for how we do this, and I have the framework sitting in front of me. But you're absolutely right. My goal for the next month or so is to turn this into a process that can be followed by, say, all of our staff with some attached videos, because you're 100% correct. This is a process that you do not want to get wrong. And I'll probably talk to the process as the very next step. But this is one of those things that is, as you said, somewhere where it is very easy to miss a step. And because you have to do a lot of processing, and I'll say it up front now, we think you're going to have to reprocess your fund 3 times.
Ew, Sean.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. I think we've just got to get into it and just rip the Band-Aid off. What is the process, please?
Okay. So the first time you process your fund, all we're really trying to do is to try and calculate the value of the pension at 30 June, assuming that it got ECPI, to get our T-bar value. And so for most people, this will just look like processing the fund as if it hasn't failed to meet its minimum pension payments. So let's just assume that it had an actuary percentage of 75%, process the fund as you would all throughout the year, all the way up to 30 June. Get your actuary certificate if you need it. I know that some of the softwares carry over last year's actuary certificate. For most funds, that's probably going to be close enough that you don't have to order a new certificate for this year. Once you get all the way through to that point, you need to lodge your failure T-bar. You do this manually. Do not do it through your softwares. I would suggest doing it through the tax portal, using the value of that pension that you've just calculated in your first processing. Now, one of the questions that comes up in that is, what do we do with pensions and lump sums during the year? For the purposes of this processing, just process them as normal. We're not too worried about things like the components, those sorts of things. Allocate them to the right accounts, but just process them as normal. That's processing one.
And what would happen if you did process it through the software?
Not much necessarily, but there's a chance that when you undo it, because the next step is to undo all that and go back to the start.
Yep.
There's a chance that if you undo it, that the software automatically picks that up and tries to undo it. And then you're just relying on somebody discarding that T-bar entry that undoes that. A lot of the transactions in this, your software will try and do T-bar entries for you. Most of them you have to discard, but this was one of the cases where if you just lodge it manually,
need to discard. Because it doesn't know.
Yeah, it doesn't know. So we do that one. That's our first processing. Then we basically undo all of that and go back to the start. Now, this is where it gets a little bit awful. We need to get our value for our prorated commutation. Sorry, for our prorated minimum before our actual commutation for accounting purposes. So we need to get our 30 June value of that pension without ECPI. So again, you process the fund relatively normally throughout the year, processing your commutations during the year if there's any, and there probably won't be many, but there might be some commutations during the year. And those commutations from the failed pension, they stay there. Because when you're looking at commutations and reporting them for T-bar purposes, you're really only worried about a value. So if you've got commutations from that pension during the year, which is unlikely, but you might have them, this is where you process those through the year, and this is where you lodge the T-bars for those. And you will do those through your software because it calculates them nice and easily for you.
And this process that you're talking about, Sean, this will apply in principle to any of the software providers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
So the slight mechanics and some of the names of the things I'm talking about might change between them.
Yep.
But functionally, this is what you're going to have to do to get the right values.
Good to know.
Anyway, so second processing, once you've done all of your sort of processing through the year, get to the end of the financial year, and then you need to adjust your actuary certificate percentage on the basis of the failed pension. So if you're applying for one with us, And I imagine most of the other actuary certificate providers are the same. When you apply for it, there's a checkbox that says, have you met your minimum pension payments for the year? You just tick no for that. Don't check it. Submit your actuary certificate request as normal, and then email our team with a general ledger and let them know which pension has failed. And they will then calculate the exempt income for the fund, if there is any, on the basis of a failed pension. And sometimes that's really easy. If you've only got one pension and it's failed, your exempt income for the year is zero.
Yep.
So nice and easy. That value that we calculate then at 30 June off that revised exempt income figure is the amount that presupposes our prorated minimum for the 2026 financial year. So that's where we get to with, that's why we have to process in the middle there. So we get that value. And then that will start to tell people, okay, we're heading into the back end of August, early September, you need to take your prorated minimum on this basis. That's processing number two. And that's all around getting that minimum pension in place. The last one we do, and this is where it's a little bit contentious, and Shelley, we've talked about this, and I asked your team if they were okay with this.
Yep.
Is we go back and we process the fund. Oh, sorry, we undo all the processing we just did for processing two. We go right back to the start, 1 July 2024, and we put a commutation through the software for that pension to move it, or those pensions, to move them back to accumulation for the affected members. Now, that is a commutation that your software will try and do because it looks like a manual commutation. Ignore that. Delete that, whatever it is in your system. You have to delete that one because it's false. We then process basically the fund again, which at this point, it's getting a little bit tedious, but we process the fund again. And this is where we go through, and I talked about earlier that any pension payments that are taken throughout the year are technically lump sums from these failed pensions, and they have varying components. Those components will be based effectively on the tax that's applied to the accumulation balance now that pension has gone back to it. So it's as if you're taking a lump sum from accumulation, and your software will do that pretty well.
So we're going to be seeing those member balances in that year of failure as an accumulation balance, even though technically it's not. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you'll get then to the end of year, your 30 June amounts, and you should still have the same numbers effectively as you did at the end of processing two, but you've now just had that period where everything's coming out of the accumulation account that needs to, and all the tax componentry is correct. That's the processing up to 30 June, and that's where you've got to do it three times.
Okay, my brain's hurting a bit, but that's okay. Actually, I don't have to do it, so that's really okay for me, not so much for you guys. But, and so is that the end of where we're at? Because then you've still got to account for that accumulation account.
Yes, and so this is where it gets, I suppose, a little bit easier from a processing point of view. We only have to do one set of processing because everything's still in accumulation and all of our sort of notional values and everything have already been calculated. So now we're just working through until where we actually do our accounting slash contractual commutation. And let's just pick a date. Let's say 15th of August. We work all the way through to 15th of August, having the client taken their prorated minimum up till then. Then we have an actual genuine commutation where the member has done a commutation. But this isn't reflected in our software because everything's still in accumulation. But our minutes and our paperwork need to reflect that as an actual commutation because that's when we've actually done it. And then we restart the pension. And so that will be effectively at that point basically just a new pension as if it had started from accumulation because everything's already sitting in your accumulation account in your software.
But that's going to be at the time that you find it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that will be, again, we pick the notional date of 15 August there. That will be 15 August, not 1 July.
So what's going to happen if you've got a client and you do all this for them and then they go to another administrator, accountant? How is that going to then follow through to them?
I think that would be something that we'd have to bring up with them in, say, our ethical clearance letter.
And right.
For you guys on the audit side of the fence, they're a mandatory must-have. On our side of the fence, unfortunately, they're still just a common courtesy. I think it would be something that you'd have a robust discussion with the client about, hey, this probably should sit with us for this year. And then once we've tidied this up, we'll move it across to your new administrator. And it depends on who the administrator is and what kind of relationship you have with them. So if it was going off to somebody that you could probably have that discussion in the background.
And of course, then to stop and start the pension, are you looking at that from a, this is a financial advice point of view, or are you, how is that working?
It doesn't need to be. So clients can obviously make the decision to stop and start a pension by themselves. As accountants, we have to be very careful about how we let them know that this has to happen without crossing into the advice territory. And we can always give people, I suppose I'd call it compliance advice. So we can tell people how the law works. So it's quite okay for me to say to a client, hey, your pension has failed. If you want to restart it and get your exempt income again, you will have to stop it and restart it. Where I cross the line there, if you do cross the line, is if you say, hey, you should stop and restart this pension. So it's the suggestion that they should be doing something, or sometimes if the client interprets it as the suggestion that they should be something, doing something. But if you're purely talking about the mechanics of it, not really a problem, as long as the clients interpret it that way. That said, it's probably good for clients to get advice in a lot of these circumstances, and it's certainly an easier conversation to have when you're talking to the advisor rather than the client themselves. For advisors, it's probably a complex topic. I would think if they have recently done an SOA, they're aware of the client's circumstances, then they're probably likely only going to need to have a record of advice to say, hey, look, this matches up with your current strategy. We're just returning you to where you were had this pension not failed. I think if you probably move outside that, you're a little bit further down the track, you might actually have to go through as an advisor the whole SOA process again to cover off on your liability. So I think it's probably a complex one for advisors.
It's a can of worms, but I think that you've covered it beautifully. It's probably a good time too to mention that there is a difference in the way that you will get through audit as to whether it is an accumulation TRIS that's been underpaid versus an account-based pension that's been underpaid. For an account-based pension, it does come under one of the CIS rules, 1069A, that we have to look at during the audit. It's not a reportable breach to the ATO. So we won't actually report to the ATO if there's an underpaid pension on an account-based pension, which obviously the member has met a condition of release. If it's an accumulation TRIS, on the other hand, it means that you've met your preservation age, but you haven't met a condition of release, which means then that money that you've, when you've underpaid that sort of a pension, that TRIS, it means that money that's come out is basically as a lump sum, which is a legal early access. So that will be reported to the ATO as a breach of Reg 6.17. Now, what is the ATO going to do about it? It's a very good question. It's probably not the worst sort of a breach you could have. I should imagine that it will be, from the ATO's point of view, they may investigate depending on whatever else is happening in the fund, especially if there's other breaches that accompany that. You might get a phone call, or worst case scenario, if you've just taken money out on top of what you're entitled to from your original accumulation TRIS minimum, you may get an audit. But in most cases, maybe, hopefully, you'll just get a letter from the ATO, because there isn't any real way that you can rectify that at the end of the day. Yeah.
I reckon the ATO would be, and it's very dangerous reckoning what the ATO would do.
Oh, that's why I've tempered my discussion with maybes and ifs and shoulds.
But I think they would be more conciliatory than they would be had it been a genuine case of illegal early access. So
correct.
Somebody who wasn't doing the right thing and was just, say, ripping their money out of the fund, I think they're going to target them a lot harder. they're probably still going to want their pound of flesh, so they're probably still going to ask you to tax this as illegal early access. But I think you're probably at much less risk of some of those further penalties that other people that are genuinely ripping their money out would be in danger of.
Yeah, and certainly the ACR would mention the reasons why this was a breach of Reg 6.17 and mention that it was an underpaid accumulation-based trust. However, there's many different ways you can talk to that. But yeah, it is something that you just need to be aware of, that there is a difference in the way that your auditor is going to treat this as well. I don't know, have we covered everything? Is there anything else that we need to think about?
You mentioned earlier, Shelley, estate planning.
Yes.
Now, I think there are some interesting implications here for estate planning, because it's going to sound like a cop-out answer, and it's the one that we all love, but it depends.
We've only got a few minutes, Sean.
So, look, there are circumstances where this can absolutely ruin your estate planning. If you have set up your benefits so that you have, say, tax-free components isolated in pensions that you intend to ship out to beneficiaries that would otherwise pay tax, and these pensions fail and they mix with accumulation accounts that have huge taxable components, that kind of whole plan that you had of getting these pensions out to these people has now gone to water. You basically have to start from scratch. That said, for a lot of people, it won't matter. If everything, so if you're the second pensioner, the spouse has already died, or if the spouse is in place and that money's going out to the spouse, not taxable. If all the money's going out to the kids regardless and there's no way that you can direct benefits in any certain method, they're going to pay the same tax whether it's in accumulation or pension. Doesn't really matter. There's also a really interesting case of people who don't have accumulation balances, fail their minimum pensions, and because of the way the mechanics work and losses during the year, they actually end up slightly better off.
Oh.
Because their taxable component would, because losses and growth only impact the taxable component. And so if you make a loss, you erode that taxable component. So there's a very small subset of people who might be better off because they're, or whose children might be better off because their pensions have failed. So I think estate planning on this one is a really mixed bag, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, and as always, as we know, it depends. Look, it's a great note to finish on. Thank you so very much for coming on the pod today. I know that it's a bit of a convoluted process, but realistically, I don't know what else practitioners are going to go and do. They may have an alternative solution, in which case we would love to hear about it. But in the meantime, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights into how we're going to treat underpaid pensions in the 2025 financial year. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Shelley.
Let's eat cake.
Let's do it.
Well, that's a wrap on today's episode of the SMSF Experts podcast. And a huge thank you to our guest, Sean Johnson, for joining us and sharing his insights into how to process underpaid pensions in SMSF software, given the new rules. Sean has reminded us that even a minor slip-up in an SMSF can have big consequences, but with the right approach to using the SMSF software correctly, they don't have to become disasters. Thank you for tuning in today. Please remember that our discussions are for SMSF compliance and information purposes only and should not be used as financial advice in any way. If you found this episode helpful, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and share it with your SMSF network. Until next time, stay curious and question everything.